A warm welcome to this special edition of my podcast, Berørt. My name is Charlotte Rørt. I am a journalist from Denmark, and I've written several books on Christian spirituality. I've published this podcast, Berørt, since 2020, most often in Danish, but I have also done several podcasts in Swedish and Norwegian, and like today, in English. My guest today shares my passion for the Spanish Carmelite monk, Fraile, and mystic St. John of the Cross, also recognized as maybe the greatest poet Spain has ever nurtured. He died shortly after midnight, December 14th, 1591, and the music playing is a choir singing his poems at the yearly Evocación in the monastery where he died. My guest has written a book about the famous writer, Transformed by the Beloved is the title, a quote from one of St. John's poems written 500 years ago. St. John was not a popular figure in everybody's opinion at the time. His fellow monks held him in a dark cell for 9 months, accusing him of being illoyal. He wanted to reform the order back to have the monks and nuns lead a more ascetic life, as did Teresa of Avila, the Carmelite nun whom he probably met only twice, but shared opinions with, and the two of them wrote letters of support to one another. Even in his dark cell, he wrote, or rather memorized, poems that were shared as word of mouth in the monasteries, where they quickly became part of the spiritual practice of conversation. He wrote about faith, about illness, about longing, and about meeting God in the dark. In La Noche Oscura, the Dark Night, as one of his most famous poems is called. He has taught me, and my guest, how to live in times of hardship. He can put into words how life is in dark times, better than we ourselves can, as my guest today rightly says. Daniel Muñoz, my guest, who lives in his native Spain, is educated as a pastor in the Church of England. He married his husband, Guy, from England in Canada, and the couple have met severe resistance in the church for wanting to live with their love in matrimony. They met when they were young, and since then, Daniel Muñoz has had St. John as a very close companion. The couple have for many years hosted retreats on St. John and Teresa of Avila, and have a very special connection to the place where Daniel Muñoz and I met, in Úbeda, in the mountains of southern Spain, Andalusia. Welcome, Daniel.
Thank you.
Can you tell me where we are?
Oh, we are in this beautiful place called the San Juan de la Cruz Spirituality Center in Úbeda. It's a very holy ground we stand on today. This is the place where John of the Cross spent the last 3 months of his life. Quite
It's tough. The place he died.
Absolutely.
But you're we're speaking in English because you're married to a guy who's English.
He's English.
And once upon a time you were a Catholic.
I was.
And then something happened.
I know.
Yeah.
Well, I grew up in the Catholic Church as 99% of Spaniards used to in those days. We are a more secular society nowadays. Mm. And when I was a teenager, I left the church, as most teenagers do, and I was always spiritually searching for something in other traditions. I looked into Buddhism and Hinduism and various other sources, spiritual sources. And eventually, when I was 18, I felt this very... I was at university in Granada. I was in a college run by Dominican brothers. And this was my first contact, as it were, with Christianity. After all these, 4 or 5 years of going away on Buddhist retreats and following various... Anyway, so I just reconnected with Christianity and I felt very strongly in my heart that maybe I needed to give Christianity a go again, because culturally, this is where my cultural roots were. So I started exploring, I started reading the Gospels again and trying to sort of engage with Jesus of Nazareth, this enigmatic, charismatic, amazing, inspirational, spiritual teacher, and that I felt a very strong connection with already anyway. But it, for me, was a kind of coming to faith as an adult, you know, kind of embracing my sort of my Christian faith of my early years as an adult, and that's when I felt that there were many things I was reading in the Gospels that didn't sit well with my Catholic context, and I started sort of being in touch with other brothers and sisters in other churches, in the Protestant churches and in Anglican churches locally. And I ended up finding my spiritual home in the Anglican church. I just felt immediately at home. It was like a homecoming thing. And it was part of it. It was the community dimension, part of it. The pastor there, the priest there, was a very warm guy. And he used to preach really well and really unpacking the scriptures in a way that was very, for me at the time, it really nourished me a lot. So that
but
put me on.
But it was in English also?
It was an English-speaking church, yeah. Mm-hmm. I've always been a bit of an Anglophile,
okay.
Ever since I was a child.
You felt at home in the language as well?
Absolutely, okay. At home, yeah. Yeah.
That's an interesting journey.
Yeah.
But then, now we're here in this house of Safran.
Yeah.
He's a Catholic.
Yeah.
So why? Why Safran?
Okay, so whilst I joined this Anglican church in Nerja, I was still part of my former youth group that was Catholic but very open and progressive. And a bunch of us from the Anglican church joined this group and it became an ecumenical group. And anyway, then I followed the process for ordination and I did all my training in England, but I always kept coming back home. And I remember on the summer when I was ordained in England, when I came back after my ordination, my friends, these guys gave me as an ordination present, a very thick book with the complete works of John of the Cross. That was probably one of the most precious things anybody has ever given me as a gift. I think I mentioned that in the book that I put that book away in a sort of top of the shelf because at the time I was very much in this more evangelical part, you know, bit of the church where I didn't have any time for Catholic things. You know, I just thought, oh, this stuff is not, it's the past. Anyway, halfway through my curacy in England, which is when you do your first post as a priest, halfway through that, I just went through one of these dark nights of the soul, spiritually, personally, inner wrestling and struggling with faith. And I remember spotting the book and picking it up, starting reading his poems. And all of a sudden, these tears began to flow. And they were tears of healing and of suddenly not feeling alone, but knowing that someone else, someone really special like John, had been there before, and he had put words to the things I was going through, to these feelings, and words much better than any words I could think of. It was a process. It was all about, I think, getting rid of a lot of my own prejudices as a Protestant who came from a Catholic background. I mean, the worst Protestants are the converts, because we think we got here and we are absolutely right and everyone else is wrong. You know, early on, you see these very zealous, kind of passionate, early convert kind of spirituality that just thinks I've discovered this. No one else has ever discovered this before. And, you know, I mean, this kind of high, spiritual high. And so everyone else, I don't feel I need to learn anything from anybody else because I am already there. Because then you read John of the Cross and other spiritual teachers and you say, my goodness, the minute you think you're there, it's the worst.
It's the worst.
You know, it's the worst. There is so much more to.
Yeah, Teresa of Avila, who was a friend of San Juan, even names that part as the worst part
the worst
a person
part.
Can be.
Yeah. It's when you stop learning, listening, when you stop being transformed.
And that is exactly what your book is called, Transformed by the Beloved. Hmm. So something started in you when you were 25, but it didn't end there.
Yeah, I mean, I was, on that spiritual journey side of things, of everything is connected, but I began to move away, gradually away from this more conservative, charismatic, evangelical, very sort of prejudiced form of spirituality, very narrow form of spirituality that helped me for a bit of my journey early on. But I felt it wasn't feeding me and nourishing me anymore in the way that I needed to be nourished. So John's poems and his writings as well, his commentaries, became a real source of... Every time I went on retreat, I just took two books with me, the Bible and John's commentaries and poems. And I would just spend... It would be silent retreats for a few days in a beautiful monastery in the Cotswolds, Bedford Priory, with these Benedictine brothers and sisters. And I just spent days just reading, praying in silence, listening, and writing, journaling. I did a lot of journaling. And about that time also, I was kind of beginning to accept and embrace my own sexuality. And this was connected with me falling in love with my... a husband, Guy.
Oh, did you meet him that early?
I met him in my first church, yes. And we were both very tormented by this because we both felt what we're doing is not right. But how can it be not right if what we feel is this very strong sense of connection and love? And we had to fight all of these kind of sick, twisted theology based on, I don't know, just, I think, very... unloving and a very prejudiced understanding of the gospel. So anyway, I don't want to digress, but this was part of that process. So, you know, me falling in love with Guy and, well, falling in love with each other, and then the whole moving away from that more narrow Christian tradition to a much more open, inclusive, and also spiritually deeper, you know, beginning to drink from this amazing source that are the mystics. You know, for me, John of the Cross, Teresa of Avila were the two big people that I began to explore.
And he's been a lifelong companion.
He has been.
So this transformation that you call your book, Transformed by the Beloved, I mean, it's what San Juan writes about Jesus. So, but you use the same title for your book.
Yeah, absolutely.
These are just words on pages San Juan. How can they move you so deeply that you transform?
But they're not. You know they're not. I mean, you read The Dark Knight, or you read Spiritual Canticle, or you read Living Flame of Love, and this fire, this fire is burning the pages almost, isn't it, as you read it. o noche que juntaste, o noche amable más que la alborada, o noche que juntaste amado con amada, amada en el amado transformada. O night that joined beloved with lover, o beloved with loved one, loved one transformed in the beloved. I think for me that verse is at the center of this journey of homecoming, really, spiritually homecoming, and of growth and of learning and of becoming more and more ourselves, who we are, who we truly are in Christ, in God, as children of God, as precious children of God made in the image of God. And it's the rediscovering who we are in God, that we are beloved by God.
You say rediscovering.
Rediscovering. Well, I think deep down, I don't know, maybe we don't, but I think there is something deep down within us that knows this, and we just need to rediscover it. It's about having eyes to see, you know, it's kind of this kind of unveiling of this veil in front of our eyes that needs to be moved away. And this is what John helped me in my process of discovering this. But the transformation is, as you said before as well, it's this ongoing process about becoming who we truly are. And not the person that we have projected, or all these masks that we put on in life to protect ourselves, to impress others, to whatever it is that the ego is obsessed with, whether it's fear or just self-promotion, but insecurities, whatever it is, you know, this taking out all these masks to find this beautiful being inside ourselves that God made us as we are, and that we need to learn to love as well. So it's kind of learning to love yourself is the beginning of it, like in any process. And knowing yourself to be loved as well.
It's been the most moving and difficult part for me, not to love God, but to know that I am loved.
Loved, yeah.
And that's where San Juan really hits me and hits me hard, is that he insists on that.
Yeah. Knowing yourself to be loved. And that is like such a tough one, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
That there is actually a place you can call home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that we don't need to impress God, really anyone. This is like how we waste so much energy in our lives trying to prove to, I don't know who, that we are worth it. I'm sorry, we are all worth it because we are children. You know, we all have this intrinsic dignity and beauty and value as human beings because we are created by this amazingly loving being that just longs for us to know that we are loved and to engage in this mutual relationship of love in freedom, of course. No, there is no coercion, there is no, but so the whole journey of transformation, going back to John, and this whole idea of is this acknowledgement that this is works in progress all the time. That you never stop growing, you never stop learning, you never stop asking questions. You know, the minute you stop, then you die. It is the beginning of your spiritual death.
Oh.
One of the things that I very often get asked is, isn't spirituality and transformation a very self-absorbing process? That is only about getting to love yourself and knowing that you are loved by God.
I don't think so. I think if it becomes that, it's not true spirituality. It's a sort of self-help kind of a philosophy. Or I think the heart of the teachings of Jesus are all about a love that is expansive. It has to begin with you, because if you're not able to love yourself, how can you love others? But then the next step in this journey, and it's not that they're different stages that have to be separated, they're all connected, is that you cannot truly love God. You know, this is also in one of John's letters, yes, unless you love the people around you. Because how can you love God who you cannot see, when you're not able to love the person who is struggling next to you, who is also created by God and holds the image of God in them? So this kind of embracing of knowing ourselves as loved by God goes hand in hand with recognizing that everybody else is loved by God, not just you. When you look at John of the Cross, who of course follows in the footsteps of Christ here, is all about this unconditional, no strings attached. This is pure grace. This is what Protestant Reformation was based on. And yet, paradoxically, ended up being more legalistic in many ways than their Catholic counterparts. You know, pure grace is a free gift that we don't have to do anything to earn it, because it's just given, is inbuilt in us. Conversion is really, this being born again is about being able to open your eyes to who you truly are. You know, it's not something external that comes from out there that just hits you. That it's an inner process that then connects with this expansive love of God. That if God's love can reach out to everybody, your love needs to kind of reflect that as well.
But San Juan's own life story is also about being unconditional and then being not expelled from the church because they didn't do that, but almost.
John experienced the worst of religion.
He was called illoyal.
Yeah. He experienced, and I relate to that now because in recent months, the last couple of years, I've gone through that myself, but this whole spiritual abuse from those who are meant to be your brothers and sisters in Christ, who are meant to care for you, love you, and support you, and they become the exact opposite. They're making your life hell. Yeah. And that destroys, it can destroy your soul, except that for John, it made him stronger because he was able to find that presence of God even in the midst of the dark night.
And even here in Ubeda, he came to Ubeda. He was actually on his way to...
to Mexico,
was invited there. He was welcomed to go there. And he became very ill and he had to stop here in Ubeda.
Yeah.
And they did not treat him well at the monastery here.
No, he was... he had a history with... I mean, this is like in every human community. Mm. He'd obviously, during the period when he was there... the provincial, the general provincial, or vicar provincial, sorry, looking after all the monasteries in Andalusia, he obviously went around as an overseer.
Yeah, he had a career that went up and down, actually. That's because right. He had a period where he was actually acknowledged as a very, also because he was extremely popular among the nuns, among the female monasteries, that he was there. Yeah,
he was their blue-eyed boy.
Yeah, exactly. Teresa Avila also spoke very highly of him, and she had held a strong position at that time. So that might have helped him also.
He helped him.
But here he made a
few enemies, because he went to monasteries where he recognized that the way that their priors or superiors were managing the community was not very helpful. Yeah. And they were either very strict or very relaxed, and he felt this is not the path that our order is meant to follow. So he obviously had runnings in, you know, with various guys. And of course, when he came to Úbeda, the guy who was the prior here in this community was one of the people who didn't like him. Yeah. And he made his life very difficult.
And imagine, and I mean, when we don't have any images, of course. I mean, he lived 500 years ago, but he was a very small man.
Yeah.
We have a bit of his leg here in Úbeda as a relic.
Yes.
It's very small. It's
very petite.
This ill man coming to Úbeda, this small monk coming to Úbeda, and he was really ill, and they didn't treat him well, but some of the monks did, especially one of the monks took care of him.
Yeah.
And then on the 13th of December, he became very ill during the night, and he died just a few minutes after midnight, the 14th of December.
I love that moment on his deathbed, when after he'd forgiven everybody there, and he had a final act of reconciliation with the prior.
Even with the prior, yes.
But I love the bit where I think it was probably the prior who came to his deathbed to read the liturgy of the last rites, you know, the sort of Sikh, we call it in our church, the sort of healing liturgy for someone who is about to die. But it basically is the last rites. And he came to read it, and John said, stopped him. Stop reading this to me. Read me the Song of Songs. So this is, imagine going, sleeping away, and going to sleep in the Lord, as it were, you know, just living this world, listening to the words of this amazingly beautiful and powerful love poem that also changed his life. Because for him, this was one of those transformational sacred scriptures, sacred writings that inspired him all along. Song of Songs. I think it's just an amazing way to go.
In a diplomatic way, I can say it's always been a very difficult part of the Bible for the churches.
For a lot of people, their church authorities, yes.
Because it does actually state that the love between one person and God is stronger than everything else, even stronger than the church.
Mm. Yeah.
So it's a bit of a rebellious part of the Bible.
Yeah, it has so many layers, doesn't it, the Song of Songs. Mm. In terms of the meaning and how you can read that as a purely human erotic poem of two people, that also is very kind of that. I mean, maybe not so much in the Judean tradition, but in the Christian tradition, sex is a taboo.
Yes.
You don't talk about it. And here is a book full of it.
Yes, it is.
Very sensual, very sexual.
And extremely beautiful.
And beautiful. And then they got the layers of like the symbolism of the bride and the groom, you know, this personal relationship between you and God, where God is like a lover that you can have intimacy with. Mm-hmm. I mean, what a powerful thing. And then, of course, the church saying, oh, no, this is not about you and God. This is about the church and God.
Yes, let's
get this straight. You know, so well, actually, it could symbolize it. It could symbolize anything you like, because poetry is open to be interpreted. You know, it's in the eyes of the receiver. But
also, you know, having this image of this small dying man lying on the table, the old oak table that's right next to where we are, actually.
Yeah.
And just listening to these words, it's such a powerful image, because. When you talk about St. John also, how could you, a young man in England fighting his own wars, feel such a companionship with this little monk?
I know. Isn't it weird?
Yeah, it is weird.
It's got to be from God, I think. One of these kind of upside down logics of the gospel. Yeah.
And to sort of wrap it up, if you can say that, because you cannot wrap this transformation up. That's what you've just said. It's a lifelong process. But if you're to say now, Danny, what is St. John for you now? What kind of a companion is he now?
He's still very much a brother in Christ that I deeply respect and love as a teacher. For me, John has been a teacher, someone who has encouraged me in my journey, in this process, ongoing process of transformation. And it doesn't matter how much you've read his poems, as I'm sure you know, every time you read a poem or you get back into one of his books and commentaries, or you read a saying of light and love or whatever it is, there is another layer of depth that takes you to a different, you know, a deeper place. John's teaching is embedded, is just soaked with this perennial wisdom. And that's why I also think that he connects with so many people from any tradition, not just Christian tradition, and from no tradition at all, that you've got this. So for me, that's what he has become, is like a teacher and a brother. And I hope, I pray that I'll keep learning and keep open to that ongoing transformation.
And one of the things that John has given me, and also you, I know, is that once you start reading him, you keep on reading him, but you also meet other people that read St. John and feel an kind of immediate connection of some kind.
It's amazing, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
And I think for me, that connection has been that San Juan or St. John, more than anyone I have read, acknowledges the necessity for acknowledging the dark sides of ourselves, the dark night, that is also a place where you can live.
Yeah,
it's not a place to be avoided. It's not a wrong place. It's not hell. Mm. It's darkness is full of life too.
Yeah.
And that's,
it's
very strong help. In the lives that we lead, and especially also in your life.
I agree, but I think it's part of the humanity. I mean, some people talk about the Spanish mystics, and in this they're very similar to the Sufi, I'm talking about Christian mystics, but the Sufi mystics are also very much the same from Spain. They're very earthy in their, they're very rooted on what it means to be human on this earth, not running away from these things, but embracing them and allowing those things to gradually be changed. The sculpture that we've got here.
Oh, yes.
Is
It's a big wooden sculpture. Is it 3 meters?
It's 2.5. It's quite tall.
Of St. John.
St. John. And I remember when our friend Daphne was making it, Daphne Fontenberg, and she's a Dutch sculptress. She made the first model, and it was him wrapped up in like a living flame of love. It was his own cloak, and it was shape of a flame to show his, and you couldn't see his feet anywhere. You could just see his hand. And we had this very interesting discussion with her, where eventually she agreed that we needed to show his feet, because this was not just some kind of monk who had no connection with this earth. It was the opposite. This was a monk who knew what it meant to be, you know,
to be alive,
to be alive, to be human, to know the joy and the pain of what it means to be a pilgrim on this earth.
Yeah, but also to be the seed that lies in the dark, in the soil.
That's right. Yeah. So we made sure that the sculpture had these feet on the ground, firmly on the ground, and the eyes on the beloved. Yeah. And that, for me, just sums up John. You know, someone who had his feet very firmly on the ground, and yet his eyes were also very firmly fixed on Christ, on the beloved. And I hope my life gradually can become more and more like that as well, all of our lives.
Thank you for listening to my podcast, Berührt. You can get more information on Daniel Muñoz, his retreats, and his book on losolivosretreats.co.uk. That's losolivosretreats.co.uk. You can also read more about me, even in English, at my website at charlotteroth.dk/English. And my name is Charlotte, like in English, and then R-O-E-R-T-H, and then .dk for Denmark. You can also learn more about St. John at the museum's website in Úbeda, which is sanjuandelacruzúbeda.com, and that's San, and then Joan de la Cruz, Úbeda.com.